This episode of The Witch Wave is brought to you by Unquiet Arcadian. Unquiet Arcadian provides artwork which explores folklore, esoteric objects, and forgotten histories, and I am such a big fan. This collection of limited edition linocuts, screen prints, and ceramics have all been made by artist Nell Latimer at her studio in Sherwood on the fringes of Nottingham, England. And I have bought so many prints from Unquiet Arcadian, including a Lolly Willows print, an Artemis print, a Hecate print, and that's just a few. Unquiet Arcadian is also the home of the Commonplace Tarot and other Oracle decks, and Nell is currently working on a deck for younger users based upon the mythic creatures that stalk the pages of medieval manuscripts. Latimer's Bestiary launches for pledges on Kickstarter at the end of March, so keep your eyes peeled for that. Learn more about Nell's mythic, magnificent art and other offerings at her Instagram at Unquiet Arcadian, and you can purchase Nell's prints, decks, ceramics, and more at unquietarcadian.bigcartel.com. And best of all, code WITCHWAVE25 gets you 25% off your order. That's WITCHWAVE25. This season of The Witch Wave is brought to you in part by Black Phoenix Alchemy Lab. Black Phoenix Alchemy Lab is a fragrance house specializing in body and household blends with a dark, romantic, gothic tone. Over the years, they've collaborated with some of my very favorite creative visionaries, including Neil Gaiman, Jim Jarmusch, the Jim Henson Company, and most recently, Junji Ito. They continually return to inspirations drawn from witchcraft, paganism, and mythology, and they also have a sister store called Twilight Alchemy Lab, which creates oils blended and consecrated specifically for ritual use. The lab recently released their annual Halloween perfume collection, a limited edition series which includes scents inspired by folklore accounts of lycanthropy. Customer reviews of their products can be found at the fan-run bpal.org web forum, and you can check out all of their perfumes and other enchanting concoctions over at blackphoenixalchemylab.com.
The world is filled with bewitching people, and you might be one too. Welcome to the podcast where art is magic, magic is real, and reality is stranger than dreams. I'm Pam Grossman, and this is The Witch Wave.
Hello and welcome to The Witch Wave. I have got a foxy episode for you today because I get to speak to Robin Ha, who is the author and artist behind the fabulous new graphic novel called The Fox Maidens. This is a story that's based on a Korean folk character called Gumiho, who is a nine-tailed fox spirit and a shapeshifter who can turn into an all-too-tempting and terrifying human woman, and it is so good! There's a rich tradition of shape-shifting fox spirit stories throughout Asia, including Huli Jing in China and Kitsune in Japan. And reading Robin's marvelous book also reminded me of that gorgeous scene in the Kurosawa film Dreams, where a young boy witnesses a fox wedding procession in the forest. And of course, fox myths show up across the world, wherever foxes naturally live, which is on every continent except for Antarctica. And while there's variation in these stories, of course, there are often connective themes of cunning, trickery, and transformation. I think I've seen a fox in the wild only once in my life, and it was actually recent, up at our little house in the hills. This one day, I saw a flash of red across our yard, and then it stopped and turned and looked at me for a moment before darting off into the woods. Seeing this fox felt like a blessing. It was this shared moment of recognition and mutual peacekeeping, and perhaps also a sign that magic was afoot. Since then, I've been thinking a lot more about foxes and opening myself up to their energy. Foxes are so quick and so stealth that I'm also struck with wonder when I contemplate how one of my very favorite artists, the witchy Vallie Myers, had a pet fox named Foxy. Foxy was an orphaned vixen who Vallie took in, and eventually Foxy would come to curl around her neck like a stole and accompany her everywhere. I don't know that Vallie ever referred to Foxy as her familiar, but if you look at photos of them together, or if you look at some of Vallie's artwork depicting Foxy and also depicting herself as a fox, I think you'll agree that familiar feels like an apt term. In a 1963 diary entry, Vallie writes, quote, "Let it all be animal, my life and death, hard and clean like that, anything but human. A lot I care, me with my red heart in the dark earth and my tattooed feet following the animal ways." Unquote. With Vallie's flaming red hair and black-lined eyes and her devotion to Foxy and the hundreds of other creatures that she cared for and lived amongst in her Italian animal sanctuary, I think it's fair to say Vallie was a real-life, magical fox maiden of a sort. So yes, fox magic is something I've been feeling called to learn much more about, and it's a recently burgeoning interest, but I'm following the trail of cosmic breadcrumbs. And so speaking to today's guest, Robin Ha, all about her new graphic novel, The Fox Maidens, felt synchronistic and so inspiring. But before we get to that, first, let's check and see what's come through on the Witch Wire.
Who is it?
Witches.
Hi, Pam. How are you? Here's a question I'm sure you've been asked before, and I'm sure you've considered. Would you ever start a book club? Or perhaps something with a little twist, an art lovers club? I know you're really busy, so it wouldn't have to be super involved. Maybe just a monthly recommendation and space in Patreon to discuss if anybody wants to. Anyway, I'm just putting it out there. And thank you so much for everything that you do. I know you put so much care and effort and time into what you give to us. It never goes unappreciated. So thank you so much, Pam, for everything, and have a really wonderful day.
Okay, so listeners, you might recognize that voice because this person actually sent in last episode's Witchwire question, but it felt so relevant to today's episode that I thought I would answer it here now. And my answer is a solid maybe. I suppose whenever I have a guest on who has written a book, such as today's guest, Robin Ha, that can be seen as an invitation for you all to read their book. But in terms of a formalized discussion around these books, I do love the idea in theory. In practice, however, I think that until I finish writing my own book this year, it would be a little bit difficult for me to take on any new elements of the Patreon. Right now, as you know, I already offer monthly virtual rituals and bi-monthly bonus episodes, and so adding on another monthly element would be a little bit tricky. And I also have to admit that I'm not sure how an online book club would work in terms of the discussion. We have a Patreon Facebook group, so I suppose it could happen there, though I'm wondering if Discord would be a better place for such things. I suppose we could do a monthly Zoom session, though I also know that those can be a little unwieldy on that format if a lot of people want to have a discussion at the same time. But I'm definitely open if this is something that folks want to do down the road. So let me just throw this topic out to all of you lovely listeners. Would you like a Witch Wave book club or an art club? Though I'm not entirely sure how that would work either. Maybe we'd discuss a new artist each month or a new work of art. A film club could be fun too. Regardless, I would love for you all to let me know if that's something you desire, and if you could give any feedback around how you've seen other people do it in a way that felt fruitful and easeful for everybody involved. Is this something that you want me to always lead? Is it something that one of you could start independently and I could pop in from time to time? Let me know. I'm very open to your feedback because it's new terrain for me, and I really welcome your input in terms of how to set such a thing up in a way that'll be engaging, but also pretty easy for us to implement on the back end at Witchwave HQ. So yeah, let me know. Email me at witchwavepodcast@gmail.com. I will take it all under consideration and discuss it with my team. And I just want to thank this lovely Witchwire voice memo sender inner for the kind words and the intriguing idea. Now, on to my guest. Robin Ha is an award-winning author and illustrator of several graphic novels, including the best-selling comic recipe book, Cook Korean, a comic book with recipes, and the illustrated memoir, Almost American Girl, which is about her move from South Korea to America when she was 14. Robin's new graphic novel, The Fox Maidens, is her first foray into fiction and is based on the Korean folklore of her ancestors. Her comics and illustrations have appeared in various publications, such as The Washington Post and The Los Angeles Times, as well as in anthologies highlighting Asian American culture, including Rise, A Pop History of Asian America from the 90s to Now, New Frontiers, The Many Worlds of George Takei, and Shattered, the Asian American Comics Anthology. She is also a highly gifted fine artist, and she happens to have a Seven Ladies of Tarot coloring book that you can download from her site as well. Robin joined me from her home in Virginia via Zoom. Robin Ha, welcome to the Witch Wave.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I just finished your graphic novel, which I understand came out a couple weeks ago, and I was so blown away. I just think it is an absolute masterpiece. Congratulations on it.
Thank you so much. It's a dream come true.
Let's talk about that. So I know you've had a few other graphic novels that have come out already. You have been working in the field of illustration and comics for a long, long time. We'll get into all that. But I really want to just start by focusing on The Fox Maidens. This feels like a very personal story, even though it's not fully autobiographical.
Not at all.
Can you talk about what made you want to tell this story? And maybe we should start by telling listeners a little bit about the plot.
Sure. So The Fox Maidens is my first fictional graphic novel. It's set in the 16th century Joseon, Korea. It's about Kai, who is, in the beginning of the story, she's about 14 years old girl. She is very extraordinary for the time that she was born. So Joseon period in 16th century is very rigid society, very patriarchal. Women are not allowed to be educated or own a property, let alone practice a martial art. But she's very, very talented in martial art and fighting. And her dad, who is the head of a royal region, sees the talent and really educates her in this martial art. And so she is going against the society in many ways. And on top of that, she's plagued by this rumor that her mother is a daughter of Gumiho, which is a very fierce, vengeful demon that her father killed 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like the premise of it. And in the beginning, even though she has all this odd quality of being very interested in martial art and very good at it, she thinks that she's just a normal girl. But when she comes of an age, she finds out that it's not true. She's extraordinary in so many other ways.
Yes.
She has to kind of find a way to get through with it without not giving up a lot of her own desire and agency.
Ah, that was so well done. I'm so glad I had you do that instead of me trying to attempt. What I think is also extraordinary in terms of like the gender politics of this is not only is Kai this extraordinary young martial artist, her father actually wants to train her in martial arts, even though he's a complicated character. We'll just say that he is going against the grain by even voluntarily yes. wanting to teach Kai martial arts. And he really celebrates some of her extraordinary gifts in that way.
Yeah, I mean, he's in many ways very much of a fictional character. I don't think he could have existed in real Joseon.
Mm-hmm.
For him to be actually announcing to his colleagues that she is better than him in martial art and she's very capable of handling herself, I can't imagine that being a real possibility.
Sure.
Back in the days. But I created him anyway, because this is fiction and this is me having kind of a thought experiment about how a society can have a huge impact on a family, even when the family members themselves are very different and capable and doing all they can to break the norms of the society to live in the full way possible. How much of that can actually change the course of their own destiny?
Ah, beautifully, beautifully said. So much of this story is steeped in Korean folklore. And you already mentioned Gumiho. This is the fox demon.
Mm-hmm.
She is a shape-shifting woman
mm-hmm.
who can turn into this nine-tailed fox. And what else do you want people to know about Gumiho? Because I could just talk about her all day, but it's better coming from you.
So Gumiho is a very popular character in Korean folklore, and she actually exists in many other Asian countries' folklore. So there's a version of her in China and Japan and Vietnam, and I mean, they're called different things. But Gumiho is always a villain in Korean folklore, and she's pretty much one-dimensional character. And the interesting fact is that when I was growing up and I was reading and watching shows about Gumiho, she was always female. So she's actually a fox who became very powerful by eating human liver.
Mm-hmm.
So liver in Korean and other Asian mythology kind of symbolize the seat of soul, just like heart is in Western culture.
Yes.
So eating liver kind of symbolizes like sucking up the vital human aura.
Yes.
There are many versions of her. The most popular version is a magical fox who ate like thousands of human lives. And once she reaches like 1,000 years, she becomes even more powerful. So she's always a villain. She's kind of a succubus-like character who lures lost travelers in the forest into her house, which is usually like a mirage. It's not actually a house. She's just conjuring up this powerful illusion to lure these lost men. And when they're all comfortable and wined and dined, they fall asleep, then she will like jump on them and like eat their liver. She's very physically beautiful. She always transforms into very, very beautiful young women.
Mm-hmm.
Just her personality isn't really approachable or relatable mm-hmm. to human readers. But I found her very fascinating because she was very different from other female characters in Korean folklore. So Korean folklore is full of very nice girls, very subservient girls who would sacrifice themselves for the men they're in love with or their parents or their brothers, their sons. So, you know, they are always doing things for other people to win their love mm-hmm. or the approval of the society and the gods, and then they will be rewarded for their sacrifice. So all of the stories basically tell the same story. There's a Cinderella kind of character, very popular. Shim Chung, she like falls into an ocean to bring back her dad's eyesight back. Like she literally kills herself, and then like God of the Sea like brings her back in this wonderful manner, and she becomes like the new queen because she's so beautiful. And then, you know, they are reunited as a queen,
right?
But Gumiho, there's Gumiho. I'm just like, eat some liver.
Yes,
I'm gonna make a story about her. I want to know more about her. So that's how I started working on this project.
Amazing. So just diving a little deeper into some of her folklore outside of the context of your story, you said she's always a villain. In your story, you give her kind of a motivation. Something happens to her, which then causes her to be vengeful.
Mm-hmm.
Is that usually part of her story in Korean folklore, or is that something you added?
No, I've never seen that kind of backstory told
yeah.
about her. So that's something I made up.
I love that because it does make her a more sympathetic character and a more complicated character, because one could understand why if something terrible happens to you, you want to then take revenge out of this sense of like
right.
self-protection. And so it kind of shifts her away from just being like this very flat villain to being somebody that like I have immense sympathy for, even as I'm also afraid of her. So I thought that was a brilliant move on your part.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's much more interesting to make a villain where you can see yourself being one of those people, right? I mean, I think we all have the potential to be very, very harmful entity in the society, right? And for her, I mean, she sought help, you know, she wanted to be helped, but the society in every way failed her.
Mm-hmm.
So she had to take the matter into her own hands.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Okay, so you mentioned other sort of shape-shifting fox creatures. I know in Japanese folklore, there's, I think it's pronounced kitsune,
yeah.
who's like the trickster fox creature.
Yeah.
And I believe sometimes that creature has nine tails too.
Yeah.
So it feels like there's some kind of connective tissue there somehow, right?
Yeah. They probably have the same origin.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I'm also fascinated by this idea of the shape-shifting woman. This is a trope that we see in folklore throughout the globe. And it's often a woman who, you know, I'm thinking about Selkies in mm-hmm. Celtic folklore, which are these like maidens that can change into sort of seal creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And in Jewish folklore, my family's Jewish,
mm-hmm.
there's Lilith, and she was also sometimes considered a succubus or a demoness. And in some tellings, she could shift into like an owl creature or some kind of like a terrifying nocturnal animal, and also then into kind of like a witchy woman.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it about shape-shifting and women that you think is so intriguing or appealing or just resonates with people on this archetypal level?
I mean, I think all women feel pressure to change themselves, no matter where they are, what background they have. I mean, I think it's kind of tied to our survival to be able to shape-shift and fit ourselves into our environment and the people we are with. I mean, I am generalizing. I'm sure there's different type of women.
Sure.
I am the way I am and you take me for who I am. And that's great. But I think most women feel that pressure to be able to change themselves in big or the small way. So I think it's very understandable that there are so many folklores around the world that has these kind of female characters that changes their shape, which is reflective of how women function in the society. And I think there is a lot of power to that ability to change ourselves. I think it's not just because, like, you know, we want to be subservient and we want to serve others and we want to just have a peaceful time with other people that we feel pressure to change. in a way, I think we really want to find a way to have the best outcome of the situation. And if we can actually make it happen by being very smart about it and finding a way that we can help others to perform the best way by maybe changing ourselves in a way that doesn't really degrade who we are. Or even, you know, like I'm an immigrant. So when I came over here, that couple of years of being in America, that was a hugely transformative transitional period of my life. But because of that time period, I have gained so much power and knowledge about myself. And now, you know, when I go to any other country in the world, I don't feel as scared as, let's say, like Americans who have never gone anywhere or lived anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I go to like Spanish speaking country and my Spanish is like zero bare minimum. I would still speak Spanish and try to connect with these people because I know that I can do it. I know that even if I don't speak it perfectly, if I could try it, the people understand that I'm trying and they will respond positively. So all of these experience that I had
mm-hmm.
in the past about trying to fit in and change myself, I think it in a way made me a lot better and stronger person.
I love that. On that note, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Picture this. You are standing under an open night sky filled with stars. A bonfire crackles nearby, and you walk towards it. There, you are welcomed by supportive, like-minded witches. In this nurturing environment, you cast spells, create enchanted crafts, learn ancient magic, and uncover your own deep power as a witch. This sounds like a fantasy we've all dreamed of, but it's actually real. It's called Witch Camp. Hi, I'm Veronica Varlow. I created Witch Camp over a decade ago. I want you to experience this life-changing retreat. Come to Witch Camp in the Catskill Mountains this summer. Last year, tickets sold out in less than 6 minutes, so go to my website to be the first to know. Go to lovewitch.com, that's L-O-V-E, witch.com, or to my Instagram at Veronica Varlow. Pack your tarot cards and your crystals. You're going to Witch Camp.
The Witch Wave is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing that you would do if you had an extra hour in your day? Some of you might say go for a run or take a nap. For me, I actually had this conversation recently with my therapist about how I live in New York City, and yet I was feeling like all I was doing was working. I wasn't going out to see as much art as I used to before the pandemic. And after talking to her, I realized I really have to prioritize this because it is so good for my soul. It feeds my soul. But it was only through this conversation with my therapist that I was able to realize what was missing and then prioritize my schedule to make more time for it. A lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time. And of course, the question is, time for what? If time was unlimited, how would you use it? The best way to squeeze that special thing, that replenishing thing, that delightful thing into your schedule is to figure out and know what's important to you and then make it a priority. Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. Therapy has absolutely helped me prioritize what matters and what lights me up, and then has helped me strategize ways to make more time for those things. I cannot recommend therapy more highly because it is so helpful to have a person who is neutral. They're outside of your everyday, and yet your time with them is devoted towards figuring out what matters to you so you can live life with more meaning and hopefully more peace as well. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, and it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/witchwave today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/witchwave. Hi, Witch Wavers. I have exciting news. At long last, we have some new Witch Wave merch available for you now through TeePublic. We decided to go with TeePublic for our new Witch Wave merch because it is a print-on-demand site, which means you can get different variations of the Witch Wave logo printed on t-shirts, mugs, totes, stickers, magnets, notebooks. Oh my gods, the sky's the limit! And the shirts come in different styles and fabrics and colors and are available in sizes small through 5XL, so you can order whatever you'll feel your most magical in. So head on over to witchwavepodcast.com/shop. Welcome back to the Witch Wave. Today I'm speaking with Robin Ha. So Robin, we were talking about your powers. And I'm so interested in the ways in which menstruation has become kind of this trope in a lot of different contemporary stories. Mm-hmm. And certainly, if not outright menstruation, at least coming of age. Like this idea that when a young girl turns 13 or turns 16, she discovers she's a witch, or she discovers she can turn into some other being. And that is something that happens in your story. So I was curious what made you decide to have menstruation be the moment that our main character realizes maybe she has even more extraordinary powers than we thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a really big mark of a woman's life, right? I mean, when you have menstruation, you know that your body has changed and you are now a being that can actually house and grow another being inside of you. Like that's a huge responsibility and power. Mm-hmm. And also I think just visually, like having blood come out of you in that region is very frightening, right? Young girls who have never had menstruation can't even imagine what that is until it happens to them. I think it's having to take care of that and having to come to terms with like every month this is going to happen to you, and for several days you're going to bleed, and several days you're going to have to be careful because you might like bleed everywhere, and you have to like take care of yourself, make sure that you're not like making a mess everywhere you go. Subconsciously, it's a lot of pressure to like change the way you live, right? Mm-hmm. Just like a very convenient vehicle, you know, as a storyteller, it just makes sense for that significant time will be the focal point of like somebody changing into something else.
I mean, it's gotten a bit better, but it still feels like such a taboo moment and taboo fluid and taboo time. Mm-hmm. And certainly there's all of these menstruation taboos that exist in various cultures too. Again, in Jewish folk magic, there was the idea of the red tent. You would go to the red tent when you were menstruating. And there have been retellings of it that actually, oh, this was like a beautiful place that menstruating people could go and just take care of each other and themselves. But there's also a version of that where it's like, you're dirty and you have to get the fuck away from us, or you're powerful. Yeah. So we put you over here in this corner, right?
Men and women alike were afraid of this period.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. I want to talk about some other magical elements of your story. There were so many terms that you introduced me to as a reader. You also do a wonderful device where you have footnotes throughout the graphic novel to sort of just translate a little bit some of these Korean language phrases and terms, which I found so helpful. So please forgive me if I mangle the pronunciation of any of these things, and please correct me. You have a phrase, is it manshin for shaman?
Mm-hmm. So we can call it both ways. Manshin is more like a respectful way to call a shaman. And there's also mudang, which I didn't use in the book. So like manshin is usually a male shaman. Mm-hmm. And mudang is mostly female, actually.
Interesting. And in your translation in the book, you say it literally means 10,000 spirits.
Yeah.
So what does that mean exactly? Is a shaman supposed to be someone who is filled with 10,000 spirits or can communicate with 10,000 spirits? What does that mean?
I mean, theoretically, that's what they mean. I'm sure there's like better expert than me in Korean shamanism, but usually when a person becomes a shaman, it's because they are being called by one specific spirit or multiple. And Korean shamanism is very similar, I think, in a way, like the Shinto, like the Japanese religion. Mm-hmm. So they are like gods of everything. There's gods of like rocks and trees and rivers and all kinds of things. And they're very, very specific like characters.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when Manshin is picked by these particular god, they have like this very, very personal, very close connection. And if you don't answer this call, usually you die. They have to choose to answer this call or they're going to be crippled or die.
Wow.
And this kind of belief is still going mm-hmm. in Korea right now, who have this very, very personal, unmistakable connection to this one particular deity or multiple deity.
Ah, incredible. And I was so interested to learn, as you tell us at the beginning of the book, that shaman were considered pretty low class. Like you tell us at the beginning of the graphic novel that there are these different sort of classes in this society that you're writing about. The lowest class included butchers, shoemakers, prostitutes, entertainers, executioners, and shaman. And I find that so interesting that they were not considered more revered, I suppose. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think shamans and that very traditional belief system, it was kind of considered like peasantry level. I mean, the farmers and the low class commoners would be the one who's seeking help from these shamans.
Mm.
So they had a few shamans like in a high level in a court and stuff like that. But I don't think they played like a huge part of the upper class society. So like, when the royalties and the aristocrats, when they like look for some kind of help, you know, they would go undercover and seek the shamans in the commoners' quarter, you know?
Yes, it reminds me of how witches mm-hmm. and other like service magicians are on the fringes of society, certainly in the real world, but also in folklore. It's like they live on the edge of the wood or, you know, in a little hut. You have to go seek them. And it's kind of a secret if you're going to have this kind of consultation with some of these magical people. So I just found that really interesting. I also wanted to ask about two magical devices that you write about in the book. The first is the Mirror of Palgwe.
Palgwe. So Palgwe is kind of a concept that is prevalent in all Eastern mythology. So it translates to eight gate or eight key.
Mm-hmm.
So if you watch any like Chinese martial art films or like the Chinese ghost story films, there will be these like shaman characters that has this symbol that is an octagon.
Yes.
I Ching.
In I Ching, it's these different, like you said, stacks of either dashed broken lines or right. solid lines, and each of them have different meanings or different energies that they're supposed right. to be kind of unlocking or referencing. And I know the mirror in feng shui,
right.
the octagonal mirror, is also supposed to be like this kind of balancing energy or amulet or portal. I just loved how it's almost like a, in your graphic novel, like a shield or some kind of like protective device against this demonic energy. Is that how you envisioned it?
Yeah. So it's not actually called Mirror of Palgwe in these movies that I watched. But when I grew up in Korea, I watched a lot of like Chinese martial art films, like historical fantasy films.
Yeah.
All of these shamans, they would carry this mirror. And there was a very famous Chinese ghost genre called Kangxi.
Mm.
They're kind of like zombies. So they're all mm-hmm. dead. And like they get up and they have like their arms out. And I don't know why they can't walk, but they're like jumping.
Yeah, zombies need to do yoga. They're just not very limber.
Right, they're very stiff. I think that's why they can't walk. They're so stiff because they're dead. Basically, these shamans would have this mirror that has octagonal like sides and these I Ching symbols. And that would be like a shield and a weapon against these zombies.
So cool.
Yeah, and a lot of Korean folklore and also like shamanism is a blend of Korean natural religion and Taoism. So a lot of our mythology, a lot of our spiritual content comes from China.
Sure.
A lot of these imageries are actually tied to Taoism.
Oh, I love that. So, can you tell me more about Bujeok, Bujeok? Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, Bujeok.
Yes. So, in your translation, you say this is Korean talisman paper. What is that?
So you can still get these if you the Korean shamans.
Ooh.
I don't know what these markings are, but usually they're in red in like yellow paper, and they're kind of like Chinese letters, but also mixed up. Chinese letters are actually pictograms. Even just like legitimate Chinese letter, they're like sometimes combinations of different pictograms in one symbol.
Sure.
But this is like pictogram gone wild. So there's like all these different, Chinese pictogram and some unrelated symbols, like all mixed into like one giant jumble of an image that's written in a piece of paper. So there's different bujeok for different things. I guess it's kind of similar to like in a modern area, if you go to like Botanica, you can get like a candle with like different symbols and different, sayings.
Sure.
So usually you will carry it with you, or you are going to sew it to your clothing or something like that, and to like protect yourself. So a lot of these things are actually for protection, from what I gathered. I don't know if you can actually use it to like harm other people. There's so many different kinds of these bujeok, and yeah. Like when I go to Korea, I would like to make one commission.
Exactly. Oh, I'm so intrigued by that. Now, you dedicated this book to, quote, for those who carry Han in their hearts. And that word Han, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly,
Han.
Han, that word has actually come up on a prior podcast episode. I got to speak to Chawon Koo, who is the author of a book called Spellbound, and we talked a lot about Korean witchcraft. And she was talking about Han as anger and rage and intergenerational pain that can also be something that fuels you. What is your interpretation of that concept? Because it seems to be so prevalent, especially as you point out at the end of the book, a lot of women's stories and women's sort of relationship to history, if I'm interpreting this correctly.
Yeah, so Han can be described in many different words. I think rage definitely is one of them. For me, it's more like undealt with grudge. So it can only happen to you when something terrible happens that you don't feel deserved of, and nothing has been done about it. A lot of women in Korea or in the world, even right now, I think they experience injustice and they can't do anything about it. So if you live your life with this thing in your heart that is undealt with and nobody seems to be doing anything about it, you can't do anything about it. It doesn't go away. It just like lives with you and it can like build up to make you go insane, basically. What I find really interesting is that when we describe Han, like we describe it almost like a pearl or like a fruit. We say Hani mechotta. So Hani mechotta means there is an entity forming and you're growing it in yourself. It's not like you have it. You grow it, you nurture it in a way like a plant would nurture a fruit.
Wow. It sounds like a very painful thing to be growing inside of you.
Yeah.
Is there any kind of other interpretation of it that has a connotation of positivity? Like, can that Han fuel you in a positive way, or is it always a pain?
I think Han is almost always a painful feeling, but like anything, there can be a positive outcome or a positive reaction to this feeling. I would say even the success of modern Korea is because so many people in Korea have Han in their heart. I mean, it can propel somebody beyond their limit, beyond what they think they are capable of, just so they can make something for themselves in their lives. I think most people in Korea have experienced this feeling. You know, we have a long history of foreign invasions, patriarchy, colonialism, war, you name it, we have it, you know?
Yeah.
Korea has been a pretty incredible country that survived through all this tremendous hardship. And for most of our history, most Koreans lived in poverty. There was like barely 1% of gentry who ruled over the entire country of Korea. And for hundreds and thousands of years, most people lived very subservient, very limited life. And on the bottom of that totem pole is always women who, you know, even in their own station, they were always forced to give up a lot of their own desire to make their family fed and be happy. So I think it's definitely a feeling that a lot of people understand in Korea, but I think a lot of people in the whole world can understand this feeling. And I think it's human nature to want some kind of justice. If you believe that something terrible has been done to you or the people that you care about, you want some retribution, you want something done about it, that you feel the balance of the world is restored. And if it's not restored, I think it can propel the person to
turn into a demonic fox maiden, perhaps?
Turn into a demon, yes.
What doesn't kill you turns you into a demonic fox maiden. That is the moral of the story. No, no, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. That is not the moral of your story at all.
Or do something before somebody turns into a fox demon.
Exactly, exactly. On that note, we're going to take another quick break and we'll be right back. This episode of The Witch Wave is brought to you by Woodland Magic. Hand-poured in small batches by an escaped academic-turned-candle maker, Woodland Magic candles are deeply inspired by nature, folklore, mythology, and literature. And I'm here to tell you, they look and smell so divine. Immerse yourself in a dark forest with candles like The Woods, Forest Floor, and Black Philip. You know I love that one. Or conjure the magic of ancient goddesses with Persephone's pomegranates, Athena's familiar, and the Kaliach. If you're a bookish witch, you'll love their literature-inspired volumes of forgotten lore, Carmilla, and The Priory. And all Woodland Magic candles are made with 100% soy wax and non-toxic fragrances, and they're available at awoodlandmagic.com. That's awoodlandmagic.com. And best of all, orders of $60 or more come with free shipping, and Witchwave listeners receive 10% off their orders with code WITCHWAVE10. So head on over to awoodlandmagic.com, use code WITCHWAVE10 for 10% off, and get free shipping for orders of $60 or more. This season of The Witch Wave is brought to you in part by Sphere and Sundry, an astro-magical atelier where you can get expertly elected materia magica, oils, incense, bath salts, salves, inks, beauty oils, and more, which have been ritually crafted during rare, powerful, and benefic astrological configurations. And oh my word, I can tell you firsthand, this is the stuff. These formulas are chosen in accord with the strict requirements of the talismanic tradition outlined in the Picatrix and other ancient grimoires, meaning you can benefit from the power of amazing astrological transits even when the stars haven't aligned. These are incredible tools for witches who are looking to embrace the manifestations and results of their spell work, especially the Luna in Cancer series. And I myself have the Luna in Cancer incense, and it is a dream to use for any kind of lunar magic. Venus Materia can be used for love, glamour, and attraction. Regulus for fame and recognition, Asclepius for healing and transformation, and Deneb Algedi for protection. I also used several of Sphere and Sundry's magical products on site in Greece during our group rituals, and they were so potent and so exquisite. I can't say enough good things about them. Since 2018, Sphere and Sundry have been a key driver in the rising tide of popularity and interest in astrological magic, amassing over 5,000 five-star reviews and field reports on their website. Most orders ship within one business day, and Sphere and Sundry is also well known for their incredible customer service, as they are their magical results, and I can attest to that as well. Learn more and get $10 off your first order at sphereandsundry.com using the code WITCHWAVE. That's sphereandsundry.com, sphereandsundry.com, and use code WITCHWAVE for $10 off your first order. Would you like even more WITCHWAVE? Do you wish that you could hear from me and my other magical guests on a weekly basis? And what about doing monthly rituals with yours truly? Then come join me over on Patreon, where you'll get bi-weekly bonus WITCHWAVE Plus episodes, ad-free WITCHWAVE episodes, and detailed show notes for all. I also lead a monthly online magical workshop, which you can attend live or watch the recording of at your convenience. Rewards for some tiers also include magical merch and contests where you can win Witchly prizes each month, as well as early heads up about my other workshops before they sell out. And you can even sign up for the opportunity to work with me one-on-one. And all backers get access to our exclusive digital coven, where you can connect to a community of other wonderful WITCHWAVE witches around the world. So what are you waiting for? Head on over to patreon.com/WITCHWAVE now and sign up. It's a magnificent way to get more magic in your life and to support the show. Thanks so much.
Welcome back to the WITCHWAVE. Today I'm speaking with Robin Ha. So, Robin, it doesn't seem as if you have turned into a demonic fox maiden, though we are new friends, so maybe I just need to get to know you better. But I know that you have such an incredible story yourself. You've written about it in your prior graphic novel, which is essentially that when you were 14 years old living in Korea, one day your mom was like, hey, we're going to go to America for the summer. You thought it was just a summer vacation, I suppose. And then, boom, you get here and you find out, nope, your mom is actually getting married to someone here and you're staying permanently. Is that a good summary?
Yeah. Yep.
And I have to imagine that was just like an insane culture shock and psychological shock. So it seems to me, just based on what I've gleaned from your writing and other interviews I've read with you, that you are in touch with your mother. You're close with your mother. I mean, your first illustrated book was all about cooking with your mother. It feels as if you have forgiven her for bringing you here. But I'd love to hear you just expound on, now that you're older and you've been living here for most of your life, you're an incredibly successful graphic novelist and artist. How have you sort of metabolized that experience now, looking back on it?
Looking back on it, I think I am fascinated by how I am the way I am now. I think when something so tremendous happens to you that, you know, in your teenage years, I think it can really go all kinds of direction, right? I mean, if you're not in the right environment that you feel supported, it's easy to fall into depression. It's easy to just have a very negative view of the world. It can really screw you up, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In some way, I think I feel incredibly lucky that even though something at the time was very traumatic, I mean, I lost all my friends, I was very isolated, I left all my cherished belongings back in Korea. So it was definitely a complete uprooting event for me. You know, there was definitely a year or two that was very bleak and dark. And I never believed that anything could get better. And I thought I will be stuck in that total isolation forever. And I will never be able to speak English. I will never be able to make new friends. Especially if you're a teenager, like everything is very black and white and everything seems like the end of the world. But I think that event really helped me to see a bigger picture and kind of believe in my own strength. Unless you go through something really hard like that, I think it's really difficult to test your own limit of how much you can stretch and be strong.
Yes.
And having that experience when I was 14, like that gave me a lot of confidence into my late teen and 20s. Even though, you know, teens and 20s is very difficult for everybody.
Yes.
It wasn't easy for me either, but I think in the back of my head, I always had that confidence that I could make this work.
You know, it's interesting. What strikes me hearing your story is that at the beginning of our conversation, you said that The Fox Maidens is not autobiographical. And yet I'm struck by this extraordinary young woman who has something really traumatic at the time happen to her when she's a young teen. And it's really the connection to her mother in the story that gives her some understanding and support about this transformation that she's experienced. So I wonder if you were conscious of those connections at all, or if I'm maybe drawing connections that aren't really there.
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely see myself in all three of these Fox Maidens, Maru and Kumio and Kai. And I also see my mother in all three of these Fox Maidens. I think it's inevitable that some of like the writer's selves are going to be in all these fictional characters.
Yeah.
These are Korean women characters. It was inevitable that I'm going to put a lot of my own emotions and my personal experience into these characters' development.
Mm-hmm.
I think in many ways, I mean, I think I see myself equally in all three of these characters. And I see these three characters as like a spectrum of womanhood that all of us experience in the world. There is that extreme of Kali kind of character who just wants to devour and burn everything and just like cause destruction and pain because she's rageful and nothing is worth saving and just have to burn it all.
Yep.
And there is the conforming and peacemaking part of womanhood who wants to just make everybody comfortable and bend herself and sacrifice her true self to just make the society flow without any friction.
Mm-hmm.
Maru's character is like that. She's born as the last class, the Chunmin class, and she, you know, is not educated. And she also experienced really traumatic events in her early life. So a lot of things have made her kind of succumb to living small. She's afraid and she is in a way very appreciative of the life she has, even though it's not much.
Mm-hmm.
And she protects whatever she has, even though it's very little. So there is that part of woman who just wants to have a peace around them.
Yes.
And then there's Kai who wants to strike a balance between these two very opposing needs.
Mm.
I think I see myself probably the most like Kai, or I want to be like her. But that is very difficult to live in that balanced way.
Yes, absolutely. Now, speaking of Kai's mother, she's more of a badass than she lets on.
Yeah.
We'll just put it that way. And I get the impression that your mom must have a lot of strength and resilience in herself. I mean, for her to choose to move to America, that's a really brave thing to do. I also understand that she was very encouraging of your illustration and she loves comic books. The phrase that was new to me is manhua. Is that related to manga?
Yeah, it's the same Chinese character.
Okay.
So it's manhua in Korean.
Manhua.
Yep.
She was a fan of, or is a fan of these comics, right? And encouraged you to take classes in drawing and making comics. And that just seems to go against what I imagine this more traditional culture that you're describing probably instilled in her. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think my mom exhibits both of these characters. I mean, she's like Moto in a way that she has so much strength and ability that she doesn't show to the world. Like, she has, you know, shown it in a way that she's an entrepreneur. She had her own business for decades, and she's a very talented hairdresser, and she has a lot of strength. But also, she broke away from the constraints of Korean society. She left everything.
Yeah.
She's like Kumiho. She's just like, I'm going to just let that all go and start completely new. And my mom is a very interesting character. She is unlike anyone that I know. So I think there is a tremendous courage and also confidence that she has shown in her own life that clearly had a huge influence in me as a young person, watching her charting this really difficult life. She had some really terrible childhood. I mean, like, really terrible upbringing, because, I mean, she grew up in Korea right after Korean War. Most people in my mother's generation had, like, really difficult childhood.
Sure.
They have their immediate family members dying in this war, living in poverty. I mean, a lot of women in my mother's generations didn't get any education. I mean, if they went to middle school, that's great. If they went to high school, like, even better. But, like, going into, like, higher education and actually, like, finding their own passion in career, like, that kind of stuff was completely excluded from them, their lives. So
yeah,
my mom really made amazing things happen for herself and for me. So in a way, I think that's kind of what I wanted to show in Moto's character, because, like, she seems very insignificant in a way. I mean, she's small and she has some physical disability, but there's all this power and strength that she has, that she actually protected her daughter. And she did a lot of things that a lot of people around her never even thought that she could do.
Yes, yes. She's a survivor and a badass, and clearly has immense love for her daughter. And I found their relationship really moving. Listen, Robin, we only have a few minutes left, but I would be remiss if I did not ask you about your own relationship to what I'll broadly call magic. A little birdie in the form of our mutual friend, Lara Antal, who listeners will know is also an incredible graphic novelist and illustrator and my part-time assistant and dear friend. She, you know, has shared with me that you have some interest in magical things. I know that you also have, like, a tarot coloring book you put out and things like that. So as much as you care to share, what is your relationship like with magic today?
I have a very ambivalent relationship with magic.
Hmm.
So when I was little, I was naturally drawn to magical stories. I loved ghost stories. I love witches. I love vampires and Chinese ghost stories. All of these things were, like, my favorite genre. So I just devoured any comics or media that had these characters in them. When I became a teenager, I started kind of dabbling in tarot cards, reading. I never do it in any professional way or anything like that. I just love the imageries. I love just kind of using it as, like, my self-reflective tool rather than, like, fortune telling or anything like that. So I did work on a few card designs that I wanted to publish as, like, a coloring book. It didn't really go anywhere. And I think it was a better thing that it didn't go anywhere when I was starting to work on that project, because I think my understanding of tarot has changed a lot in that past, like, 5-6 years.
Mm.
But, you know, I think art making in general is really closely tied to magic.
Yes.
We really don't know where our creativity comes from. We all consume these media. We are surrounded by things, but what we create after consuming these things are all different. And there is a reason why we are obsessed with muses. We believe there is this muse or this kind of divine connection that allows us to create these things. And if you're a writer or a magician, you know that if the muse doesn't want to communicate with you, that there is nothing you can do, right? Whatever you do doesn't look good or it doesn't sound good. And you just have to wait until this muse reconnects with you, and you just have to believe that it will, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you are devoting your life in making art, I think there is no way you're not going to be spiritual, even if you're not like practicing witch or you're not like a religious person who goes to church or something like that. You have to be open to your inner intuition and life that is not fully explained in any kind of material scientific way.
Yes.
I am not really practicing anything like fundamentally structured in terms of like religion or spirituality, but I'm really open to reading and practicing things that, you know, might help me in terms of being creative. I mean, having Lara in my neighborhood, she's doing a residency right now in Winchester. And like, that was really great because she's like so much better being versed in this kind of witchcraft and magic. For me, like being surrounded by people like her who are really into spiritualism and witchcraft, I think it's kind of like what I want the most out of being spiritual. It's like being around people who are open to these kind of ideas and can influence me in this very positive way.
Mm, beautiful, beautiful. Well, listen, Robin, you have influenced me in a very positive way. I love the Fox Maidens so much. I am just so dazzled and so moved by it. So huge congratulations again. Before we go, what is the best way for people to connect with you and connect with the Fox Maidens and all of your other books and work?
So I hope one social media, it's on Instagram. My handle is Robin Ha, my name, Art.
And that's it?
That's it.
So easy. Go to Robin Ha Art on Instagram and you will find all the goodies. And everybody, run, don't walk. Get your copy of The Fox Maidens today. It is absolutely glorious and magical and moving. I loved it so much. Robin, my heart is so full. My liver is so full. Thank you so much for being on The Witch Wave.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a fun conversation.
That's it for the show. Thank you again to Robin Ha for sharing her foxy fabulism with me.
Do you have questions, feedback, need some witchly advice, or just want to share something magical that happened to you recently? Please do drop us an email or a voice memo at witchwavepodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, and you just might make it on the Witchwire. The Witch Wave is a Phantasmophile production written and produced by me, Pam Grossman. This episode was recorded and edited by Josh Wilcox and or Walter Nordquist and myself. Our theme music is the song Hand and Eye by Lycanthia. Our new Witch Wave logo was designed by Thunderwing. And special thanks, as always, go to Matt Freeman, Lara Antal, and Cece Pascal. You can check out information about this and other episodes on our website and now buy Witchwave merch over at witchwavepodcast.com. Please subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app, and do consider giving us lots and lots of sparkly stars and glowing reviews. It really, truly does make a difference and helps other people find the show. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at WitchWavePod, and you can check out my witch emoji for iPhone by going to witchemoji.com or downloading it in the App Store. My book, Waking the Witch, is available everywhere now, and the witchcraft book I edited and co-authored for Toshin is as well, so thank you for checking those out too. And if you want more WitchWave, or you would just like to support the show, please do join us over on Patreon. That's patreon.com/witchwave. Thank you so much for listening. Witches are the future. I'll catch you next time on The Witch Wave.